Hello and welcome to What Else You Do. I'm your host, Masao. I'm an indie producer in Montreal working for Studio Cut to Bits. And today our guest is Mei-Ling Tang. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, thanks, Masao. You can call me Mei or Mei-Ling. I am a contract team lead at Bungie. I'm working out of Montreal while the rest of my team sits in Seattle. Before joining Bungie, I've worked at places like Stadia, Ubisoft, which is where I met Masao, worked at places like EA and Warner Brothers as well. I am a Malaysian, born and raised, lived there for most of my life before leaving the country to work in different parts of the world, like Singapore, Paris, and now here in lovely Canada. So that's a bit about me.
So this is part of our Interviewing Asian Game Devs That Work in the West series. So how do you identify? Mm. Do you still identify specifically as Malaysian, or now that you've been here for a long time, like, do you think of yourself as like a Malaysian Canadian, or like how does your identity shifted now that you're in a different place?
It's a very interesting question. It's something that I kind of grapple with as well, right? I feel that at its core, I'm still very Malaysian. It's where I grew up with. It's the culture I identify most with. But now that I'm working with my team that's based in the US, you know, Canadian jokes come up and everyone just like turns and looks at me because I'm technically the only Canadian representative in my small team. So, you know, it's just this very fluid type of identity that has kind of like weaved itself into how I see myself, how I represent myself. And, you know, different circumstances arise and you kind of just wear a very different hat and you put on a very different identity. There's a fair amount of code switching that happens too, right? Like depending on who I'm interacting with, I find myself kind of like moving between these different spaces based on how I identify in that group. So, you know, if I'm hanging out with fellow Malaysians, then I speak Manglish, which is Malaysian English. It's just like this hodgepodge of like Malay and English and some Chinese in there. I find myself like, you know, speaking with a Malaysian accent. And then if I am working with my American colleagues, the kind of phrases I use, the tone that I have it's more Americanized, more North American. So it just comes and goes depending on who I'm interacting with and what the situation calls for. So I think that it's a very long roundabout way of saying that my identity now that I've spent, you know, a certain number of years here is very fluid. And it depends on who I'm with and the community that I'm hanging out with, essentially.
Kind of along the same lines of that, like how Asian do you feel? Do you feel like you're less Asian than when you lived in Asia? Or do you feel like you're kind of more Asian in your kind of perception due to your surroundings?
That's a very interesting one. I know that when I'm here, I feel 100% Asian. It's like it's very hard to ignore the fact that I look very different. I sound very different. My preferences are very, very different. But when I go back to Malaysia, somehow the locals can kind of like call me out. It's like, that doesn't sound very local. It's like, do you live overseas? I try to not like do anything that would give it away because in my, you know, like Malaysian brain, I'm like, oh, I'm going to get ripped off because this person is going to like think I'm I'm not local. And just like try to make a quick buck off me. So, you know, I try to like, you know, sound as local as possible, but somehow people kind of like realize, like, you know, either because I haven't been in the city for so long, I'm just like using a bunch of like outdated slang words, or I get lost in the city. I think it's probably also because I don't get to speak the local languages as often, right? So like my Malay is probably really rusty, or like when I speak Cantonese, like, you know, my accent is all off, and then the auntie's like, you don't sound local.
How does that make you feel?
A little bit sad, right? But, you know, it's part of really not being geographically in a place that kind of like makes you lose touch a little bit with the local life there. But at the same time, it is part of, you know, just being an immigrant. It allows me to also be able to step away and, you know, take a look at my experiences growing up, to kind of like re-examine a lot of things and understand my own culture in a very different way. I think over time, it's given me a lot of perspective and appreciation of kind of like just the small things that we do that make us who we are. And I think being here, being in Montreal, we do see that big, you know, gap between how we were brought up and how we treat the people around us. It's also very, very different. So it's both like good and bad. It gives me like nostalgia. I know I do miss home. My family's there. I do miss a lot of the culture. I miss, you know, being able to go out to mamak stalls. So mamak stalls are our version of kind of like night market stalls, where you can kind of just like hang out. You can have coffee on the side of the street. It's just like very ad hoc type eateries that people frequent late at night. So we do have pubs, but, you know, for people who can't go to pubs because, you know, Malaysia is a Muslim country. So friends who can't consume alcohol will go to these mamak stalls. And that's where we kind of like hang out, we chat, we watch football matches. That's kind of like, you know, what we grew up with. I miss that, but also being far away from it gives me more appreciation and helps me understand, you know, like what makes us so different than what I'm experiencing here in Montreal.
So you moved out of Malaysia primarily for work, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I left Kuala Lumpur in 2008 to join Ubisoft Singapore. So that was like the first time I left the country. Although Singapore, you know, it's still very similar to Malaysia in so many different ways. So it didn't feel like a huge leap or a huge divergence from what I already knew. I still felt very comfortable. I think when I left Singapore to work with the Ubisoft headquarters in Paris in 2013 was when I probably felt, you know, the, I guess, like biggest culture change. Culture and, you know, in terms of language as well, right? Like, you know, being dropped into the middle of Paris, not speaking a lick of French was not the easiest of experience. But that kind of just really opened up my eyes. It's one thing to, you know, travel to a different country and kind of just like have a very touristic experience of a place. And it's another having to live in the city, reestablish your network, trying to work, trying to learn the new lay of the land. So, you know, that was kind of like a big leap from what I encountered moving from Malaysia to Singapore.
Would you want to go back? Like, if you could, like, for example, establish a studio in Malaysia, like, would that mm-hmm. be ideal for you? Like, where do you want to live if it wasn't for the fact that, like, there are, in the, like, you know, video game,
like, what takes me away?
The generally you have to be.
Mm-hmm. That's a question I ask myself all the time too. It's a pretty tough one to kind of answer. I know that what I enjoy doing is working in video games, and specifically what I'm doing day to day now with my current position at Bungie. So I work a lot with building social systems for Destiny. It allows me to, you know, work on a topic that I care a lot about, which is creating welcoming, inclusive, and safe spaces in the community. Knowing that, you know, I have the luxury of and the privilege of being able to work on a subject that I care a lot about, and having a team that also embraces and shares that same philosophy, it's going to be something that is very hard to replicate somewhere else. you know, we have a lot of incredible local talents in the Southeast Asian region. I don't have as much concern if I was just to set up a, you know, another games company. But I think, you know, knowing that I want to work on the subject matter that really, that I care a lot about, that's going to be a bit more difficult because we're going to have to be able to find experts in a very specific field. It's something I cannot easily replicate in Southeast Asia.
And on top of it, like that's a very specialized position, right? That what you do.
Yeah.
You exactly. kind of require like a large AAA team to kind of fit into.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not, you can't like, you can't very easily make a like an indie game where you focus on integration of, I mean, I guess you could, but
you could,
but like, I think it is definitely a position that lends itself to large multiplayer games that are.
Mm-hmm. We do see success with companies like that game company who made Journey, and I think they've had quite a bit of success with their mobile indie game Sky. I know SpryFox, another you know, indie company based in Seattle, they've also been really, really successful with, you know, building up very cozy, just socially friendly and welcoming experiences in the indie space. It is definitely possible, but I guess, you know, it's very different in terms of the reach and how mainstream that experience can be when working at a AAA company. That, you know, it's just very different fields altogether, and you have
for sure
you know, building a niche experience for a very specific audience versus building one that, you know, is broader and has like
has millions of monthly audience. Active users. Yeah,
exactly. So it's just different, but I'm not closing that door entirely, right? Knowing that we've seen successes out of these indie companies gives me hope that it's something that we may be able to replicate if we ever think about going back to the Asian region to start something up. So and you know, we've seen a lot of large AAA companies also move into Asia, and looking at them as, you know, like it's a huge potential market for game development as well, right? I think Riot has just recently opened up their branch in Singapore as well. You've got like Ubisoft Singapore, who's been there for a bit. Sony had a branch open up in Kuala Lumpur, I think, in the past year, the start of the pandemic. So, you know, a lot of these companies are slowly moving into the Asian region in search of viable talent. So mm-hmm. it's great that we have people invest in the industry, invest in the region to build up more expertise. So I think we can get there. I think it just takes time and a substantial amount of investment for sure.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I think we got sidetracked to what do you want to do?
Yeah.
so let's say the option is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you want to move back or go somewhere completely different?
That's very interesting. I think I feel pretty comfortable where I am, you know, in Canada right now, but I'm always open to having new experiences. Going back to, like, for me, working with people means that you're going to build relationship. You're going to have people around you that you can rely on, people you can trust, people you're comfortable with and share the same philosophy and values as you. I think, you know, over time, because I've spent so much time here, here's where I've started building a lot of those key relationships with. If I were to go back to Malaysia, unless I can convince a whole bunch of my friends to move with me into the region, I'd have to start from scratch. I'd have to rebuild a lot of that trust, that relationship. So it's not going to be as easy, I think, to just kickstart something with a bunch of people that I've never worked with before. And I think that, you know, the key to any successful team is being able to find like-minded people who share the same values as you. And I think that, you know, regardless of where I go, that's going to be kind of like the razor in which I will assess who I want to work with.
That makes sense. I mean, it's definitely the case for us. Like our studio, we've most of us have known each other for over 10 years and mm-hmm. worked with each other. So, mm-hmm. you know, like I can definitely understand why you want to, well, the importance of working with people that you know and trust is very important for the success of studio for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think that trumps, you know, things location like geographical location. Yeah.
Let's talk about working in the games industry. So you are an Asian woman working in a predominantly white male dominated industry, at least in the West. Mm-hmm. How has that affected your experience?
I think when I first started off in the industry, things were a bit more challenging, you know, trying to carve my way, trying to build trust amongst my coworkers. There was a lot more resistance to ideas, you know, just being able to have my voice heard. I do have to say that over time, you know, the awareness that has come up with regards to a lot of these topics tied to diversity, the need to increase equity for underrepresented groups in the industry has really helped, you know, help me build my confidence, find allies, and really lean hard on what I've learned over time to kind of just, you know, find my voice and be a lot more confident in, you know, what I'm doing today. I believe that, you know, a lot of women before me had kind of like paved the way to bringing us to where we are today, in making the industry overall feel a lot safer for folks like me. Admittedly, we still have a long way to go. Almost no time goes by, you know, each week where we don't hear some sort of, you know, legal case brought against a large, you know, AAA company for unfair treatment of their employees. Sexual harassment that still goes on means that, you know, it's still ongoing. It's still happening in the industry. We have a long way to go, but things have improved over time. People are a lot more aware. It helps to have allies around who will help speak up as well when they feel that you're not being treated well. I remember distinctly in, I believe this was at EA, where I had a coworker who was, you know, I think he was a lead, who was a co-lead on the same project as I was, who came up to me after a meeting and asked me if I was okay because he noticed that another coworker of mine kept talking over me, kept interrupting what I was saying. And he offered to go have a word with that person on my behalf. And that kind of struck me as, you know, an experience that I've never had for the longest time being in the industry, like someone noticing that this was happening to me. And I didn't notice it myself because I was probably so used to being treated that way that, you know, I've just learned to kind of like cope with it or work around it. But for someone else to notice that this was happening to me really changed my mind. It really opened up my eyes to also not just look out for when those incidences were happening to me, but to keep an eye out for when it was happening to other people and to be able to step in and intervene on others' behalf when that was happening. So I think that, you know, it takes a long time for the industry to kind of like come to this point where people feel like they have a safe space that they're able to speak up, not only on behalf of themselves, but on behalf of others as well. And that fight for that change is one that's going to take a long time still. And I think that me going through what I've gone through, me having seen what I've seen, helps me be a voice as well. And I think that my voice carries a weight because I've personally experienced a lot of these things. I've seen it happen to different people. And I think it's, like it or not, a responsibility of mine to be able to speak up and make the industry a much safer and better place for people like me.
Something that came up in a previous interview was how game development, especially AAA game development, kind of requires people to be a certain way to kind of get your way. you really do have to kind of be confrontational and loud to a certain extent. And, and I think it's contrary to how we are raised in Asia. Mm-hmm. And the conversation was talking about how basically we kind of have to like modify ourselves to fit the environment to, you know, in order to kind of thrive and succeed in it. Do you think that you've had to kind of change kind of how you are and who you are, and or not necessarily who you are, but how you interact with people, to because you are in a leadership position and have been for some time now. Do you think that was something that is that something you've observed in yourself?
I'd like to think so, yes. But I also like to think that I wasn't the more quiet, submissive stereotype that people have of Asians. When, you know, I think when I was leading a team back in Malaysia, back in the days, I think I had a certain amount of, you know, just like going against the grain of how people thought women should be and how we should behave. I always thought of it as, you know, working to my advantage because, you know, it's like I'm already in a situation where I stand out and am different from the rest of the people around me. What else do I have to lose, right? So I'm like, okay, might as well just go all in. What's the worst thing that could happen? People already probably don't have like a hyper positive perspective of me. So I'm like,
which I'm is just crazy. Gonna you're go like all in. One of the nicest people I know.
You know, I was one of the few, like, I think there were like three women taking the same course as I did in university. So, and I think we were like 20. So there was just like three other women with me. When I graduated, I was for the longest time the only woman in my course who like stayed in the industry, worked in the industry for multiple years. And that was something that, you know, took a little like getting used to, but it's always being like the odd one out in the room. it's just eventually you kind of like not care about what people think. It's like, I'm already weird. I'm already like stand out from the crowd. I might as well just go all in. I remember when I had to do a kind of like a call or a team meeting with one of the projects that I was following as a line designer with Ubisoft Editorial. So back then the CTO, you know, like is French. So all these team meetings would happen in French, but I didn't speak a lick of French. So what I did was like, I used my phone to record the meeting and I had to get like a coworker to transcribe the meeting to me so I could type out the report for the team at the end of it. And I remember very distinctively when I, you know, went to pick up or retrieve my phone after the meeting was over, when we were like listening to the conversation that had happened, people were asking like, who's this person? Why are they doing this? I think there was a lot of, you know, nervousness around being recorded in one of these like large team meetings. But then it's like, I have to do my job. And unfortunately, you know, the meeting was happening in French and the only way I could get around this was, yeah, to like record it and get it transcribed later on. But it just made me like, you know, cemented my my image as like the weird person in the group. And eventually, if like you kind of get used to, you know, being the odd one out, it's like, yeah, you have nothing else to do. It's just go all the way, speak your mind, share what's at the top of mind for you, and who knows, you might actually change people's perspective, or you might bring a very different opinion to the table that people didn't think about because of what you've lived through and you know, your experience and what it brings to the table. So that was kind of my approach and the way that I thought of myself and what it means to kind of like stick out like a sore thumb all the time.
Kind of related to this topic, that is something I've always really admired about you. You're very firm, and you are very clear in what exactly it is that you want to get done. But you have always been like, you're still a kind person, and I think that's something that's
sometimes very kind of you.
Hard to find. You do kind of have to fight for your features and your ideas in this industry, and I think in that process some people become very hard.
you can convince people in two ways, right? Like you can try to get them to do what you want in a very forceful way. And in the end of the day, you know, no one's happier for it because the person did something for you reluctantly and they probably didn't agree to it. But then, you know, it was just this like dynamic that was not as equal and the person did it out of, you know, having to do their job. Or if you can convince someone why they should do something because, you know, either the data shows that it's the best thing to do or you have something to back up what you're saying with clear evidence, or you can actually convince them to change their mind. I much prefer the second route, right? Because it yields longer term results. You get people on your side when you have to defend what it is that you're doing in the future. Time and time again in game design, you may have a good idea and, you know, people may not agree with it all the time. We see it happen constantly. But then if you can convince people why your idea is standout and it's the best solution for the problem that you're trying to solve, then great. Then you can have your producers, you can have the rest of your stakeholders make a case that really supports your design. Or you just tell people, like, you should do it because I'm your lead and you don't know what you're talking about. And people just do it. And it's like, I don't know, this person wanted it this way. Therefore, this is how I'm implementing it, right? You're just not going to have people fight for you.
Buy-in.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of just like my philosophy of working. Someone once told me, I can't remember anymore. So I'm sorry if I'm not giving you credit if you imparted these wise words to me early on. It's just, you know, people aren't going to remember what you say to them at the end of the day, but they're going to remember how you made them feel. So I always kind of like go with that philosophy of like not particularly the most quotable person, but I hope that, you know, in the time that we've worked together, I've made you feel good. You know, I've hoped that I've empowered you and made you more confident and a better whatever it is that you're doing. So that's kind of just my philosophy as a whole and how I work.
I think that's really great.
Thank you. I mean, I hope
not that you need my validation,
no. But I do hope that, you know, managers do the same thing for the people that they work with too, right? Like the industry is small, and we just need to make it, you know, kinder place for all of us to be able to work with each other. And I think that goodness is contagious. People model the behavior that they observe and replicate. And if we have more success cases of people who succeed based on kindness, empathy, creating safe spaces and making the industry a much more welcoming place to be, then that is going to be kind of like the main way that people will resort to working. But if what's rewarded, what's actually appreciated and what's elevated is, you know, being unkind to people, taking advantage of others in order to succeed, or, you know, just replicating systemic injustices, and that's the best way to succeed, then we're just like, you know, in this like awful downward spiral in terms of who we are as a society.
Well, we've been going for a while, so I think it's time to wrap up. Do you have any final thoughts to share for our listeners? Any Asian thoughts to share?
What is an Asian thought?
I don't know. You tell me.
I think that one of the observations that I've had being Asian is, and I think that, and I use Asian as a very like broad and loose term here because I've seen similarities across multiple cultures, which is the willingness to kind of like share with others, like what you have. It's all these like small things that make so many Asian cultures so beautiful. You know, small things like when you go to someone's house, you always bring a gift. Or when you travel overseas, you make a trip overseas, you buy these like trinkets for friends and family back home, like those fridge magnets. They need like they need to be moved, right? Like they're not going to sell themselves, so they need like all these like aunties and uncles to like go buy them for their family members. Culture, like, you know, sharing your food with each other, all these kind of like small things that make Asian culture beautiful and unique. That's something that, you know, we need to continue to kind of embody and share. And I think that all these micro affections is the new word I learned from Twitter yesterday, right? Micro affections help make the society a much more pleasant place to be in. And I think it goes the same for the games industry as well, right? How we treat others, the quality of the relationships that we build matters so much. And we have a lot to learn from the Asian culture on this aspect.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and have a good day.
Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you, Masao.
Thank you for listening. Thank you to Dave Wallace for providing the music, and thank you to Therese Lance for providing the logo. Bye.